Welcome to the Department of Homeland Security, the officially unofficial podcast for The Boys on Amazon Prime Streaming. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about three episodes. Episode 1, Episode 2, Episode 3 of Season 2 just dropped today, and we're here to give you our full coverage of it. No scene-by-scene recap on this first one, so let's talk a little bit about the format of this show up front. Because we have three episodes to cover today, and that would take an enormous amount of time and really benefit no one, we're going to be doing these not in scene-by-scene recap style, but in what we call a half-assed podcast, which is where we talk about the various themes and anything we liked or disliked about the episodes and kind of just dispense with the details.
Yeah, it's essentially all color commentary, no play-by-play. And yeah. I think it's appropriate because I imagine that the vast majority of Boys fans are going to do this like we did and just binge the three episodes.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you got a long week between content. You're going to come on and you're going to be looking for podcasts to like break things down and analyze and speculate. And hopefully we will fill that bill with you.
Yeah. And then on episode 4, when they start releasing them one per week, we're going to be going into full scene by scene recap and analysis mode.
Yeah.
Hopefully that'll serve everyone.
Yeah.
We will be also including feedback in future episodes. So go ahead and, you know, drop us a line at dhs@baldmove.com if you hear anything that you want to comment on or have any questions or anything like that.
Yeah, agreed.
Let's get to it.
Yeah. What did you think just overall? I mean, we kind of talked about this in the previews, but if a person jumped right from that or just skipped over that and want to hear our impressions of the first three episodes, what's your general vibe?
The Boys are back in town, man. You know, it's The Boys. Like, everything that we loved about season one has carried over into season two. It's ultra violent. It's highly stylistic. I'm finding a fair bit of heart in this thing with Huey. I'm liking what they're doing with him, and, you know, some of his you know, battles, I guess, you know, battles of will with Butcher, stuff like that is really good. And I'm really enjoying the addition of Giancarlo Esposito, who plays Stan Edgars, because that to me is one of the most fascinating parts of this show. The idea of a super being like Homelander, who's a psychotic, and just trying to wrangle him, control him. Like, what do you have that can deal with this guy if you're just a mere mortal?
Yeah. It's funny because we've been watching the Michael Jordan, The Last Dance documentary, and one of the more entertaining things is seeing like how Phil Jackson, this like famed coach and motivator, can keep various disparate people like Michael Jordan and Dennis Rodman in check, like constantly challenging, but constantly checking their egos, letting them be the people that, like, how do you make that those ingredients into a soup? Well, what's Giancarlo Esposito's doing as Stan Edgar is like that to the nth degree. He's trying to manage Superman, you know, like keep his ego in check, keep his powers in check. And he's, as far as we know, just a dude.
Yeah.
And him, first of all, he's one of the few people that you could put up there, and I would believe that like Homelander would at least think twice before he would just go right to ripping his head off. One of the few actors that's that got that much gravitas and that just much dead face menace.
Right. Him, Anthony Hopkins, like there are a handful of people. Sure.
There's a few you could probably think of, but also it just injected a much needed level of intrigue into this season.
Yeah.
Because like this season comes back, it's got all the dark humor. It's got all the full body explosions. It's got all the just ridiculous shit that happened in the first season. Carl Urban is still a ton of fun to watch as Billy Butcher. The team, the boys themselves are kind of rounding them into shape and having, you know, personalities that I care about and interactions, relationships I care about. But yeah, like adding, because Elizabeth Shue's energy with Madeline was kind of like someone who was, it was a downward spiral. Like she kept on increasingly desperate efforts to keep Homelander engaged and enthralled and subdued. And she was running at the end of her rope of what she could do, what she could offer him.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, now you've got somebody who's like just Yeah, again, every single time they have like a show off, a showdown, and it happens, I think, once per episode in early going. At least there's definitely a significant one in the first one, significant one in the third one.
Yeah.
The energy just like, it just really crackles between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And feels really like it elevates the material. So I'm really excited about season two. I can't wait to see where things go. We should probably get right into it, because I'm going to start talking about, in, you know, my general kind of like wrap up kind of questions, big picture kind of questions.
Yeah, right.
If I keep going.
Okay. Yeah, let's do it. I don't know how deep in the minutiae you want to go, but like one of the things in episode one that I kind of should have seen coming, or should have like inferred from watching it, is there's a screen when the Deep is like drinking himself stupid at a bar. Mm-hmm. He's watching this screen and he's getting angry about it. And at the bottom, you can see in the little ticker, it says that, you know, whatever is streaming live on Vodafi. Did you notice that? Mm-hmm. Like hashtag Vodafi.
I didn't see Vodafi. No,
they have like their own streaming platform, I guess, like a Disney Plus or whatever, called Vodafi. Yeah.
It's like Marvel IRL streaming. Yeah.
I thought or that was DC, like, okay, yeah, that makes total sense for this corporation to have that, given, you know, what they do.
Yeah.
And that whole mercantile nature of the show is like a big draw for me. Like, you know, it's there, it's ever present in episode one, or it's in the very fabric of the show. But like the idea that these superheroes are just as much product as they are people is, you know, it's probably not too far off from the life of a super celebrity, but also they are superheroes, which makes it a little even weirder and more interesting.
Yeah. And it's also got a lot of, you know, we talked about the Last Dance documentary. It's also got a lot of like professional athlete too.
Yeah, yeah. Especially with Adrian.
And it's right? it's a little bit of rock star. It's a little bit like, you know, it's a little bit of movie star. It's like all those kind of fascinating things put together. You want to stick with the Deep a little bit, because he's providing a lot of the comic relief.
Yeah.
Which is wild, because I remember how much we hated him last year, and how much, you know, because he was a real shit.
Some of our characters still hate him.
For good reason. And he had all the, like, you know, just baseline redundance, kind of like lameness of Aquaman, and then you make Aquaman a sexual predator, and then you have him not handle like life out of the limelight very well. But I just enjoyed like how far he's fallen. Like, he's getting kicked out of like a TGI Fridays because he's like, hey, they cut me out, that's my shoulder, they cut me out of the picture of the Seven.
Yeah.
And it's juxtaposed with like them literally cutting him out of the bronze statue. That's like there's some construction going on, because they were they're replacing was it the Lantern, I think, was the guy who is retired or left, and why Starlight came in season one. They were like putting the finishes touches on that, but then there's this dude with like an angle grinder cutting the Deep out of that big brass or bronze statue. I thought that was that was pretty entertaining. Him getting arrested at that water park.
Yeah,
where he's at like a splash mountain. He's like, you think water's fun? You should try being down in the Mariana Trench, where it's just cold and dark and crushingly alone. And then he gets caught into this. I think it's certainly a Scientology spoof.
It's called the Church of the Collective.
This Church of the Collective, when she offers him the book, it literally looks like the Dianetics book, which is the L. Ron Hubbard science manual for Scientology. She's talking to him. She's shit talk. Because at first I thought, I was like, oh, he's just going to get therapy. I'm like, well, this is really interesting. But then she started shit talking therapy, and I'm like, oh, right. This is just a Scientology spoof.
Seeing Gretchen from Breaking Bad in this scene.
Yeah, she was really good as this a Scientology auditor. I love how like there's something sinister going on with Fresca.
Is this like the ingratiation period where they're just trying to make them like him?
But it's specifically Fresca. He shows up at the jail. It's like, hey, man, I'm glad I can get you out of here. Have a Fresca. He comes in with like two cases of Fresca later on. And like in like episode three, when the Deep starts wigging out, the therapist gives him, well, the auditor gives him another Fresca. But there's also just like when the Eagle was talking about his traumatic experiences. Like, you know, I found out that one dark day that a quiver can only hold so many arrows. And when I ran out, and then he started getting caught up and like, and when you think about it, I got arrows and these other guys got tech nines. And then he corrects and he catches himself. I just like that stuff is really funny. And I can see an almost unlimited amount of the deep getting comeuppance for being such a shit last year.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I don't know what the Fresca really deal is. I almost feel like I'm not remembering, like, in season one, he loves Fresca or something. Like,
I think it's a Scientology thing. And, like, that. Here's the thing. Like, I don't...
It's like a Kool-Aid.
I know there's a lot of... There's a peculiar... Well, maybe that's what it is. Because I was thinking, like... Because I know there's a lot of peculiar things about Scientology. And there's a lot of this stuff, like, just parodied right up front. Like, and they talk about his operating levels versus the Scientology operating thetans, suppressive energy versus suppressive persons. I know that like Scientology gets behind like pet projects. Like if any, you know, L. Ron Hubbard's book gets optioned for a movie, they buy out whole theaters to make sure that it has a good opening and stuff like that to make sure the local libraries are stocked. Mm-hmm. I wonder if there's like some kind of special, some kind of special relationship with a product. Like, are they big on Faygo? That's more Insane Clown Posse, and like this is a spoof of that. Or, but you might be right. It might just be like cults. What are cults known for? Drinking Kool-Aid. Well, what will be the funny Kool-Aid for this show? Be Fresca.
Yeah, I don't know. See what they do with it. But yeah, I liked it. And this idea of like Eagle came to terms with his thing by like saying, "Oh, well, archery is a timeless art, and it's got some value in that regard." And like,
right?
No, yeah. But ultimately, it's useless. Come on, as superpowers go, it's a pretty lame one.
Yeah, that's long been kind of a whipping boy on the Marvel side is how this useless Hawkeye is, and this is just like, you know, Hawkeye coming to grips with like him being the seventh wheel, not even the seventh. He can't even make the seven.
No.
I want to talk about Stan Edgar, played by Giancarlo Esposito, because we talked about a lot about him in the beginning. But I thought it was really effective in this episode how his showdown with Homelander was foreshadowed by him just running roughshod over these people from the federal government sent to negotiate. And he's just like, you know, well, in combat, who are these heroes going to report to? And he's like, me, of course. And then he's like demanding his Yankee White security designation, which I believe is the security clearance you need to get into the Oval Office. Like, if you don't have those YW things on your badge, Social Security Administration will fucking kneecap you. Oh, yeah. That Yankee White, but the Secret Service will gank you if you don't have that. And then he's like, whoa, you just want to stroll into the White House and start barking orders? And he's like, well, hell yes. It shouldn't be a surprise that he takes on the actual most powerful man in the world if he's going to go against like the most powerful government in the world.
Yeah. So this is where I'm a little disappointed in the show. And really? it's not the stuff they're showing us, but it's the stuff they're not showing us, because I feel like there has to be in this scenario a lot of pants shitting going on in the U.S. government when you're facing down a power that could just totally override whatever power you think you have. They should be actively working against this threat that they see in the Vought Corporation and these superheroes. And it doesn't feel like they're doing anything. It feels like they are the dumb fucks who are just like going, okay, I guess we'll do whatever you say. That's not the U.S. government.
Yeah, but I think this is a world building note that maybe they didn't do a very good job of in season one, or because we weren't doing full coverage in season one, we didn't do a very good job of like picking up on. But like Giancarlo in his epic confrontation with Homelander at the end of this episode mentions that, you know, Vought's been important to the U.S. government since World War II with Soldier Boy, which I think you're supposed to understand is broadly Captain America, and he smashed the Nazis and the Axis powers, and you know, like that's began the working relationship of the United States government and Vought. And the boys, you're supposed to understand, is this clandestine organization that the U.S. government has to keep a check on them, to clean up after the collateral damage, which apparently is up to 34% acceptable in like a city scale.
Right.
But they've done that. But this is, you're supposed to understand that this is like the end of a 75-year-old slippery slope. And these federal government folks are literally the last vestiges of trying to resist the power of these superheroes. And Homelander manufacturing this super terrorist threat has got them to where they feel like they have to capitulate. So it's like, okay. It's not like overnight these guys showed up. It's like, this is a long cold war that has gone on between Vought and the U.S. government, and the U.S. government's ready to, you know, privatize national security.
That's fucked up.
And I felt like I caught a lot more of that on the second watch of, like, you know, like listening to the world building of, like, oh, okay, so, like, you know, because there's like a lot to process. There's the fact that the founder of Vought was a Nazi scientist. He was like the Dr. Mengele of the Dachau labor center, and he made this compound V very early in that war, which that I feel like that's interesting because V doesn't have anything to do with heroes, right? But it does have a similarity to the V2 rocket, which is how we got Warner von Braun, right? The all the Nazi moon guys that we got from the rocket science department of Nazi Germany, mm-hmm. and put us on the moon. Like, there's a lot of analogies pointing to that kind of stuff. I really like those scenes and juxtaposed with a hero that we haven't seen a lot, Black Noir, mm-hmm. like him single-handedly taking down that superpowered terrorist cell and tanking. Like, as I was a Black Noir was like a slightly superpowered Batman, but he tanks like a tactical nuke strike from this guy.
Yeah. Which surprised me.
And he's also, yeah, yeah. And he's like also psychologically fucked up. And I'm wondering how much they're playing that with like Batman being this little lost little boy, because mm-hmm. he's got this like inappropriate trying to bond. So when he was fucking around with the rabbit with the kid, the terrorist kid, was that him being thoughtless and cruel, or is that him trying to be like, oh, there's a kid and he's scared, so I'm going to try to like do some kind of thing to make him feel at ease? Like, you know, I can't get it. And then
it
later
was so
on,
weird that I don't know. I don't know the answer.
And there's later on, I can't remember if it's this episode or the next one, where when it gets out into the public that V is, you know, an engineered thing. Clearly Black Noir was not one of the ones in on that joke, because you see him like sobbing as there's this, he's watching this news thing on a thing about like the harmful psychological effect of children taking V. And I'm thinking like, Bruce Wayne, except for if he wakes up and realizes that all of his pain that he thought he went through and his orphan story was like some kind of government backstory, and they just gave him a Batman pill. And like all this stuff that he's done is engineered and he had no say in it.
And was sanctioned at the very least by his parents, right? Like that's the implication here. And I think that's one of the implications that they go with. Which character is it? They make a couple of quick shots that allude to that.
I know that Maeve was like mad that her father's being interviewed. This might be what you're talking
about.
Yes, that
was it.
He's like, I had no idea. And she's like, no idea, my ass. You know, like there's all this frustration of like child actors and child
sports
figures. You
took me to those mall pageants and like you were on top of that shit. You're telling me you didn't know I was being injected with stuff? Bullshit.
Right. Or you didn't even sign it. So I thought that stuff was really interesting, and also just seeing Black Noir get to work, like cut that woman's throat and like caught the blood in this cup, and then caught the like this crazy acrobatic catching of the cup, and he ripped a man's head in half like a bloater from The Last of Us. It's gruesome shit.
Yeah, I
gruesome
love it.
Shit.
I love it. Going back real quick to Stan Edgar and Homelander and their whole like, you know, control battle, the battle for primacy here. This is the most fascinating part of the show to me, because it's you know, it's brains versus brawn, and you have to wonder, okay, how smart is Homelander? We've seen he's actually pretty damn smart, and he when you're fucking with him, he gets that you're fucking with him for the most part, and occasionally like these people will have an edge over him. Madeline Stilwell had this psychological hold over him.
Yeah.
Right, because he's not as developed mentally as maybe he should be for a man his age, but he doesn't have to be because he's superpowered. And then with Stan Edgar, I don't know how like super smart they're going to make him or whatever, or if he has superpowers, but like this idea that he could somehow control Homelander via just essentially just his will and exerting like a mental psychological hold on him is going to be interesting, especially when you throw in a child. And this is like one of those compounding things where, like, okay, Homelander now knows he has a kid. You can see in the speeches he's giving to his kid, like, he's got a certain vision for what that future is going to be with him and his child.
He's grooming him.
Yeah. I mean, they're going to be the Darth Vader and the Luke Skywalker and rule the Empire together, you know, like,
yeah, it's father and son.
Yeah. It's, but at the same time, that kid can be leverage for someone else over Homelander. Right. And, and if you can control the kid, which Becca seems to be able to do in some regard, you can potentially control Homelander. And I wonder if they're going to lean into that, you know, because, like, Vought has been controlling this kid for a very long time, right? Vought has their hooks deep into him. It's going to be interesting to see that power dynamic play out between Edgar with control of the child and Homelander, who wants the child to be something else.
Yeah, and I also wonder, like, that's the something we talked about in the preview, is like, does Edgar have a trump card? And I thought maybe he might have some, you know, he took a V himself on the sly. Maybe. Does he have the leverage over his kid that we don't know about? Because we know that this organization is keeping, you know, contact of Becca and has cameras in her, mm-hmm. and they know more about her schedule than she does. So that's an interesting thing. Or also, it could just be that, like, if all he's got is leverage, I hope he's not misunderstanding that Homelander's smart, but he also operates in ways that are not necessarily in his long-term best interest, because I thought this episode did a pretty good job of showing that Homelander honestly regrets killing Madeline. Mm-hmm. You know, when he's going through her old house, and or not his old house, her old office, and he finds her mini fridge that still has some breast milk, and he's gulping that, like,
the way he sticks his tongue into that bottle, so disturbing.
Oh, such and a Anthony great Starr, job. Like, that's the thing. He just swings for defenses. He doesn't give a fuck.
Yeah.
Like, he was on Banshee doing ridiculous shit for years, and now he's got this high-profile thing. He's doing such a great job of showing a man who's like, you know, it felt really good to burn that bitch's eyes out of her skull sockets, but I kind of miss what my mommy, my weird psychosexual mommy. So, like, it's entirely possible that Homelander would do something that would threaten his son and get him killed and regret it. But on the other hand, you know, Stan Edgar is reduced to atoms.
Right.
So it's like, I hope he has a little bit of some kind of backup other than leverage, because, you know, Madeline had her holds on him too, and it didn't amount for a hill of beans in the final analysis.
Yeah, fair. No, but it's the most fascinating part of the show to me.
Yeah. I really liked, you know, they do, again, this stuff isn't subtle. It's very hit you between the eyes with a hammer kind of commentary. But I liked the funeral for Translucent and how it was shot kind of like as a mixture of a campaign rally and like a schlocky telethon.
Right.
And how Homelander's just expertly playing the media and the American people, like, leaning into this patriotism that's it's false patriotism, care for human beings that's a false care, and everything is just being like, apparently Translucent's dying words are, get the terrorist, Homelander, for me, you know, like, and then they have Starlight coming in singing the schmaltzy song. It's just so fucking terrible. And they do even this thing where they show the media working with the superheroes, like, hand in glove, because, like, the Chirons, you get the idea that they were they're matching up, like, instantly, like, as Starlight does a point, the Chiron underlines it. But there's one point where the Chiron comes, like, a second early, as if, like, the media is just essentially repeat, you know, they've already got this material. It's all been approved. It's being put out. Like, this is all, like, hell, I one of the things that was impressed me is, like, more and more you see whenever you have a fake news organization, it's essentially, you know, you don't have, like, BNN, you have with Wolf Blitzer, you actually have CNN with Wolf Blitzer in the universe, and that drives me crazy. It's like, come on, you're a journalist. They have, like, fake news organizations and stuff, but, like, I'm going to have to pay more attention. One of them might be VNN or something. They might be owned by Vought. They're just definitely, like, they've infiltrated all these levels and have this stranglehold over the American culture.
Yeah.
I thought that stuff was, like, really cool instances of world building.
The other thing that struck me about episode one, and it didn't strike me until the very end when Butcher walks back in. I'm like, fuck yeah, Butcher is back. But also it caused me to pause and say, hey, I actually didn't miss Butcher in that episode. Like, I'm glad he's back. I think it's awesome. And I love Carl Urban in this role. Mm-hmm. But episode one held up without him, like,
yeah,
really well.
In fact, it felt, the Boys felt a little bit more balanced because there was debate, there was, you know, some discussions back and forth between them. They were building a relationship away from Butcher, so when they brought Butcher back in, it felt like a destabilization and like a step backwards a little bit, which is as fantastic as I think. And it's fantastic, I think, as Carl Urban is, like, that's a really cool dichotomy to set up. They'll, like, get him out of the picture long enough for Huey to think that, and he's got this all this crazy rationalization, like, well, maybe I could be like John Connor, where you don't think I'm just an annoying teenage brat, but turns out I'm secretly awesome. And, like, Mother's Milk and, like, Frenchie kind of, like, skeptically processing that claim. But shit, you know, that's kind of who they are, right? They're not superpowers, but they're superpowered, but they're kind of awesome. And putting the Boys into this reduced level where they're forced to being the medic and the gun runners for this mob organization. They're living in a literal sewer. And they're on the run. All of them are wanted criminals because Vought has made sure that they are the blame for Madeline's death, and they're the blame for all the stuff that's gone wrong. I thought that stuff was a really good touch. And we also found some, speaking of the background television, Madeline's baby blown clear from that blast and was recovered in a yard like 17 miles away. So we've got a confirmed super baby, right?
Am I misremembering, or did Homelander do that? Because, he got Butcher out.
Oh, maybe.
I feel like Homelander might have snatched Butcher and the baby.
I guess he's fast enough, he could probably do both, like, in some kind of crazy Flash kind of way. Maybe you're right.
Yeah.
Maybe you're right. But I interpret it as, like, because I thought Homelander just didn't give a shit about the baby because he was jealous of the baby. So he saved Butcher, and then the implication was that the baby was just flown free and survived.
It would have been, you know? It would have to be a super baby if that's true.
Yeah, so, like, I wonder if there's going to be something that comes of this baby later on.
Yeah, could be.
It's still in the plot, so they want us to know that.
Mm-hmm.
That's also, so you said you really like what they're doing with Huey. It's one of the things I don't like. As I mentioned in the preview, I think it's something they can build, and if he can successfully turn into some kind of John Connor badass, or they can derive some comic value out of that, it'll be. But, like, right now, he's just so hapless, and one of the things that I am sick unto death at 43 years of old of age is seeing characters lie to each other. And this is, like, to the nth degree, because Starlight's like saying, they started early because, like, they're kind of vibing and they're meeting each other in secret on the subway and their legs are kind of, like, touching. There's this physical intimacy. And then they also do an establishing shot of, like, Huey's just sitting down there in the sewer making himself sick, watching her doing all these glitzy appearances. There's kind of, like, this Hollywood faux relationship that they're forcing on her and Homelander. So they're looking like they might be canoodling, and she's meeting all these other handsome people that are playing superheroes that... And he's jealous, and that jealousy turns her off. And then, you know, she gets him dead to rights in this episode, or maybe it's the next one. And she says, essentially, like, don't lie to me. I know when you're lying to me. I can tell it when you... And he just, again, to protect her. But again, she's bulletproof.
She's a big girl. She can make her own decisions. I don't know why he's trying to protect her.
We talked about some of the fucked up shit that goes on in the show. What do you think of Gecko, Starlight's contact from her old Capes for Christ days, which is another thing. I love this kind of, like, Heartland, Red State superhero shit that their mythology they're building. Gecko, really interesting use of regenerative powers.
Yeah, I feel like Gecko shouldn't have to live in the shadows. I feel like Gecko should be able to do it. How is this different than a fire breather? How is this different than... person who, you know, works in the circus putting pins through their cheeks to demonstrate, you know, I'm the man with no pain. Like, it's a superpower. I feel like he shouldn't have to be this BDSM hooker thing that he's got going. Like, why can't he do this on a stage, like, in front of 100,000 people, you know?
Because it's clearly his fan base was built amongst conservative Christians. And just like, you know, the
fan base.
Well, it's funny because, like, right now in the news, you got this Jerry Falwell Jr. or someone that's, like, you know, he's is loves getting cucked or something. I don't know. I don't really give a shit about people's sex life. Like conservative Christians clutch their pearls for that.
That's what I mean.
He is, you know, like he's out on this, like where he's kind of cobbled together this living of maybe going mall to mall and signing autographs and also doing lab. He's clearly at a lower tier where he's a working superhero, man. He's sure. Letting them put his eyes out for testing shampoo and cut limbs off to do all this other stuff. He's doing the BDSM hooker stuff on the side.
He could have a booth at every Comic-Con. He could go around and just say, "This is the chop my arm off booth," right? Like,
I wonder what the law would say about that. Like, if you intentionally maim some, it'd be kind of like
no harm, no
foul.
For
him, it's like getting your hair cut, right?
Right.
Like if you had like hair that could instantly regrow and you let people style it and, you know, cut it for a fee.
Mm-hmm.
But
and
I feel like
clearly like either doesn't care about the pain and has felt it so much it's not a problem, or doesn't feel the pain.
I was wondering which, I don't know that we'll ever see this guy again, but I was kind of wondering that because he was wincing a bit, but also could just because blood was spraying him in the face. It was a crazy scene. That dude just hacking at his arm with a machete. I wonder if he charges more to have an emotional effect about it.
Oh, it depends on the body part too.
That's true. Because like, are you a leg guy, an arm guy? Do you want to do
like 400 for the arm, 1,000 for the dick, apparently.
Yeah. But I don't know, like, and also, like, is that guy going to eat his arm? Because he said, I get to take it home, right? Like, what
I
is...
I thought it was more of a souvenir. I hope the guy's not going to eat his arm. That's where I draw lines.
I bet you if you do a Venn diagram, the set amount of people that want to hack off a person's limb in a bloody fashion and a set of people that want to try human flesh, they overlap a little bit.
At least.
Like, I'm not sure if it's one out of 10 the customers go for the dick upgrade, and of those, one out of 3 eats it. But, like, there's some ratio of numbers there. But I don't know. Like, I thought the Gecko was a really good kind of world-building fucked-up detail. And also, it's a window to, like, Starlight getting a little bit hard because she just uses him completely after, like... After she fluffs him up and kind of like, he's clearly delighted to see her again. And they had this history. I actually like the detail of like, oh, you're the best Jesus at the, like they used to do like literal passions where they'd nail him to a cross.
Nobody
and some
could
shit
take
like
pins through the hands like him.
But yeah, she just uses this guy.
Yeah.
I wonder if we do see him again, I imagine it's going to be like Homelander peeling his face off for retaliation of stealing the V, but
yeah, that's the stuff I'm liking with. I like that part of Huey's storyline too. So the main thing I like about Huey is this challenge between Butcher and him, and the heart of the group and all that stuff. But like him and Annie, I think are developing interestingly as well, because as he's, you know, trying to deal with all the shit that he's dealing with, he's still lying to her. It's pushing her further away. It's pushing her more toward Vought. Honestly, like she's having to get hard, like you said, and that's going to take its toll, right? Whether she wants it to or not, whether she thinks she can still remain the innocent Annie that she was before, we see that that's eroding already.
Yeah.
How far down that road does she go before she's just a lost cause, you know?
Especially since like they make a big point about perhaps Butcher needing Huey as a canary, like a moral canary. Creason looks like she doesn't have Huey as in that role. Can't trust him. So like what will stop her? I wonder, because that'd be an interesting way to go. Like they could redeem Maeve somehow and push Starlight into villainy. Although it does seem like they have their fair share of, you know, heroic villains in the show already. I like the detail of like the boys not being really sure if Butcher killed Madeline or not, and the baby. They're like, it's like within his wheelhouse for sure. Maybe it's a little extreme to kill a civilian like that, but on the other hand, and like Huey has this stabbing at taking the like leadership or real leadership. He's got this plan, you know, we're going to steal the V, we're going to send it over to the authorities, let's contact the CIA lady. And then Frenchie shits his pants when the Miss Rayner, the CIA handler's head literally explodes right as we were about to get some like real tantalizing information.
Yeah.
Also, it's not entirely clear to me, and it feels a little convenient for the terrorist that the smuggled into the country to be the linchpin at this investigation. Everything kind of revolves around, and somehow, what's her name, Makima? Kimiko, the deaf, the mute woman, is like embroiled in that too. I'm wondering how they're going to make that satisfying, especially when we get to where we leave everything at the end of episode three here.
Yeah, I don't know.
But yeah, introduction to Butcher was great. Like, this guy just getting knocked down the stairs.
Yeah.
And saying, it's a real mess. But don't you worry, Daddy's home. Again, fucking love Carl Urban in this. The last big thing that happens this episode is the introduction of Stormfront. If you know anything about the word Stormfront and the city of Portland currently, you might have an inkling about where this character is going. But technically, that stuff isn't revealed until episode three, so we'll let it go. How did she present to you when she first walked onto the stage?
Did they even do this in episode one? I thought they did this in episode two. Because they do it after they get to the blind superhero, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah, we didn't talk about the death of the blind superhero, but it happens in this episode for sure.
Seriously? Okay.
Because episode two is her kind of like media jaunt with Starlight, and then episode three is her turn to darkness.
All right. Sorry. What did I think?
Let me ask the question again.
About
Stormfront? Yeah, just say, like, when she walked in, like, what did you think about her presentation?
I was a fan in the beginning. It's easy to be a fan of someone who's calling bullshit on bullshit. And she's definitely doing that with Vought. You know, obviously by the third episode, I think she's a reprehensible, disgusting person. And I'm completely off the Stormfront train. But yeah, I like how they introduce her, and she's such a counterpoint to the rest of the superheroes that I'm actually like not even sure. The biggest question mark I have in my head about Stormfront is why Stan Edgar wants her in there, because she's so off brand for the Seven. And he personally put her in there. And so to me, it's like, oh, is he trying to disrupt Homelander's flow? Is he trying to give something for Homelander to fixate on so that in the background he can be doing his Stan Edgar shit and Homelander can be distracted? That's my best guess.
And from a brand perspective, you know, like there's this throwaway joke in the last season of Rick and Morty where they're talking about buying some consumer thing. And it's like, you know, you should buy the time train, not buying the time train is an act of buying the time train.
Okay. Yeah.
Like, she could be all the people like, you know what? Fuck the Seven. They're too corporate and they're like blah, blah, blah.
Too goody-goody.
Well, what if you bring in like a Dennis Rodman into the Seven, and now it's like, oh man, Stormfront might go to Vegas and, you know, do a wrestling match in the middle of a supervillain showdown. Like, that's like, I'm invested. I didn't give a care about it. Because when she came on the stage, like, you know, she seemed like very much like very millennial, very almost social justice warrior-y or progressive, and like she's shitting on corporations and all these fakers, and seems like she's pretty like pro, you know, girl power, but in like a like a sincere way and not like a fake kind of strong female roles kind of way. And they subvert that for sure end of the third episode. But I don't know. I like that, the fact that there's this new Ashley kind of mousy Madeline figure that Homeland completely subverts into his creature in like 1 30-second terrifying scene. Yeah. And I liked like how terrified she was that like when Homelander like turns his laser beams on her and's like, oh, we've got a new, because he just executed the deaf guy. Mm-hmm. And now we've got this. And he said, you know, he's very down on having any kind of like another female or ethnic person. And now there's another female on the team, and his just kind of impotent rage with this Stan Edgar. I thought it's another great check on him.
Yeah.
Okay. We should probably move on to the second episode.
Yeah, let's talk about it. It's called Proper Preparation and Planning.
And I believe that's from the complete phrase is proper preparation and planning prevents piss poor performance.
Okay.
Which
P-P-P-P-P-P.
Yeah, I think this is like this is the opposite because there is no prior planning and there is a lot of piss poor performance here.
Yeah. And all that preparation, you know, that I feel like Huey has been trying to do. And you know, he doesn't quite prepare either. You know, he doesn't think about how they can track him, and how like texting might be just as bad as a phone call, which how could he not? Like, what is he, 65 years old, doesn't understand the text is essentially the same as a phone call and probably worse because it sticks around longer. Like, I feel like they made Huey a little naive in that perspective, but
No,
Butcher is
Huey is a
worse, right?
little.
Butcher is seat of the pants. I'm just gonna get this shit done, and it doesn't matter how or collateral damage. Fuck it all. Let's do it.
I mean, Butcher is a little emotionally compromised, and also the way Huey is conceived is he's a little bit of like Schrodinger's protagonist. He can have the affect of a 13-year-old or a 75-year-old as the plot
Right.
requires. But I like the alpha struggle that him and he, and Butcher have that Huey immediately loses. And as much inroads as he did with the other members of the boys in the last episode, when Butcher puts it up straight up, it's like he's like, "What are we supposed to follow you? Then now that you're back like lemmings?" And he's like, "Well, who else are they going to follow?" And at this
And
point in the
he's got
story,
a response.
that's yeah. But I thought it was fascinating, like catching up to like where he'd been. Like apparently been to Fort Wayne, Indiana, is where Homelander dropped him off. Why?
I don't know.
The fact that he like wrote all these basic details on this back of this napkin and the crayon, and that's probably going to be a big thing through the season. But it's also important thematically to his character, and at the end of episode three, which we'll get to for a little bit. But I don't know. Like it's also cool how they went from Raynor's head blowing up to like getting. I guess this is this Grace, the colonel, is the former. Director of the deputy director of the CIA, and is the one that I think you're supposed to understand recruited Butcher personally and kind of started the boys division way back when. But she does kind of play a important, almost MacGuffin role in this series of like without her, Butcher's dead in the water. But with her, she magically supplies them an address that she thinks this, you know, terrorist guy is hanging out at. They find they go in and infiltrate this building, and like Kimiko has been set trying the whole time to explain to her that she's got some connection with this guy that is revealed that turns out she's his brother. There's this Shining Light Liberation Army, which I'm not sure if they established this last season that she was saved from that organization, but they completely established it this season that you know both her and her brother were abducted at some point and experimented on with this Compound V that apparently Homelander gave to them, and he's got super telekinetic powers, essentially.
Which are
Is he?
hand-based specifically. Like he has to move his hands in order to use his powers.
Yeah, so it's pretty easy to neutralize him, and he is neutralized several times with just essentially a roll of duct tape. I don't think they did a very good job of establishing Kimiko as a character last year, and now they want me to care about her and her brother. And I kind of get there because it's inherently a sad story, you know? These people that saw their parents die and have known nothing but these terrorists holding them and experimenting on them their entire life. It's a pretty sad and tragic story, but like compared to like Huey and like Butcher's whole deal, it's kind of down there in terms of stakes for me.
Yeah, same here. I'm not exactly sure why, though I think like one of them being a super terrorist has something to do with it. Like I get it. I understand all the reasons, right, why he would do the stuff he's done. You know, they killed his parents, but then they you know, they gave him superpowers, but they experimented on him. Like that it's a
And also, you
convoluted
know,
mix of emotions, but
and especially when
I
you
don't
think
know.
about like what America with the seven at its back looks like around the world, and you talk about how like the screaming demon came from the sky and incinerated their village, like
And they're freedom
this
fighters,
is
that kind of thing. Yeah, I get it.
Yeah, like this is like the random rage you would feel towards a drone strike, except personified into the most, like imagine Barack Obama personally was circling around Afghanistan, lasering people with his I-beams. Like that's a whole other level of hate to America when it's like it's that personified. And I feel like you're supposed to understand that, like, as bad as maybe the shining light army is, well, they're fighting, they're giving us the tools to fight these other worse people. So yeah, it all kind of ethically and morally framework and all that kind of stuff on the sliding scale that this show works on, it all kind of makes sense. But again, I found that there's the one thing in this episode or these as collection episodes I found hard to kind of engage with. I will say that, like, this Kimiko stuff is kind of the thing that moves the boys' relationship forward, because Butcher is forced to, at the end of this episode, level with his team and kind of, like, beg them for help and acknowledge that they have every right to tell him to fuck off.
Yeah, which I it's guess... hilarious to me, because it's, like, at a moment where he realizes that this group is amenable to emotional manipulation. So it's like, how much of this is him seeing, oh, they're responding to Kimiko being part of the group and wanting to help her, so if I open up here, I'm gonna have the ability to manipulate them. It's tough with Butcher to really tell if he's being, and you know, MM's like, are you fucking with us right now? And so they're aware of it too, but like, ultimately I think these guys are good enough that they're gonna help Butcher even if he's kind of an asshole.
Because, you know, the situation is fucking bleak, you know, like Becca at the hands of Homelander with the kid in the balance. Like that's, you know, especially Mother's Milk seems like he's a pretty family oriented dude. That's got to be something that would motivate him, I would think.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, with Frenchie, like being, you know, realizing, oh, that's Kimiko's brother, and like all that stuff is all tied in. And I think that it works really well, right? They're bringing...
I do too.
This, thematically, they're kind of connecting all these characters together, and it's making it feel like they're starting to come together as a group, even with the personalities that are so outblown, like Butcher. Even he is starting to come around and understand we're a group.
You want to talk about Homelander and his weird parental role that he's playing in his kid's life?
Okay.
They reveal something about the Homelander, and Becca has a deal that's implied that she cooperates with him and isn't an asshole, and he doesn't kill Billy.
Yeah.
Billy Butcher.
I think so.
So that explains why he got dropped off in the middle of BFE. That's interesting that. Then also when Homelander, because she takes off at some point, drops his kid off at the piano lessons and makes a desperate drive over to this government research facility or Vought owned research facility and kind of begs them for help. And they say, no, pound sand.
Yep.
We have gotten orders not to antagonize Homelander.
And he'll get bored and move on.
And he'll probably get bored and move on after he kills you or your kid. But when Homelander's going through her like intimate drawer, her secret intimate drawer, it does imply that like she's still, you know, carries a torch for Butcher.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's a really good. I thought that was a really good scene, having Homelander in their house and doing that, drinking their milk. This dude milk, man.
Like it's
that
gross.
Comes from a cow titty, dude. The effective. And then seeing the corporation watch Homelander through the cameras that are put in her house, I thought that was all really creepy and off-putting and done well. Especially since she, as a mom, is trying to provide as much normalcy for his child. Like, you know, she's doing all this terrifying work while he's fucking around with the piano teacher. I thought that was a really nice touch.
Yeah, and then that conversation he has with his kid, you know, the conversation about isolation and their superpowers and stuff like that is disturbing. He's effectively like telling this, I don't know. It's interesting to me to see the isolation as experienced by a being who's superior to literally everyone else on the planet. And how he's trying to connect the dots there between what that feels like and what it feels like to be isolated because your mother is keeping you in a bubble. It's like there's a legit emotional inroad here for him to make some progress in changing his son into what he wants him to be. And I think he scores a point when he says, you know, what do you think this kid is going to think when he understands the life you forced him to live is so limited?
Yeah. How do you think these powers work, though? That's something I was speculating, because, like, do you think the kid knew that he was super this whole time and was going along with his mom's plan just because he was afraid of his own potential or things like that? Or do you think it's like something that has to be like some kind of strong emotional outburst has to happen? I know that's kind of like that's an X-Men trope. Like, you get your mutant powers at some time in your adolescence, but it's usually some kind of like really strong emotional thing that brings it out, like a first kiss or a fight with a bully or your parents screaming at you or something like that.
Yeah, I don't think they really give us any answers on that in this show yet, but.
Because, like, Butcher was able to use a baby like a laser gun.
Just squeeze it a little.
Last season. Yeah, just kind of, like, so it's like maybe it's when she says, I've tried to give him as normal as a life as possible. Like, that's means something. Like, I've tried to keep him as calm. Everything is rational. Everything. And probably getting, she's probably getting some help from the lab rats. Because I wonder if that's the thing is, like, that they themselves don't know if this stuff is inheritable. Like, you know, we use we put the syringe into the baby's ass and its eyes start glowing. If this is a true genetic, you know, transference, that might be something that they're intrigued by. Because there's got to be a reason that they are going along with this kind of like, and even Homelander picked it up when she says, we decided he should have as normal life as possible. Who's we?
Mm-hmm.
She's not talking about Butcher, I don't think. I don't think Butcher's had contact with her since she went missing. So it must be these scientist types.
Mm-hmm.
So that's but you're right, he does have a genuine emotional inroad with this kid and his feel. In fact, if he shows up 2 years later and this kid's a punk teenager, he might have a real easy time of turning him.
She's been through the easy kid years, right, as far as figuring out what will satisfy them and control them.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers have a chance to exercise their rights under the Patreon pact we've made by voting for the next pulp movie that Jim and I will be covering. If you're one of the elite few backers at the executive producer level, don't miss your chance to influence us. Hurry over to patreon.com/baldmove and vote in the latest movie poll before it closes on Wednesday morning.
And for all other club members, we've got an all-new episode of Lunch with Jim and Aaron this Friday afternoon. Catch the live stream at 1 p.m. to interact with us and your fellow munchers over on Patreon, or you can wait for the podcast to drop later that day.
If you want even more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
Where do you want to go next? The deep?
Yeah, let's do it. It's pretty good.
Beep, beep. It's time for the deep. He's deep in the Fresca cult and goes deep into a cup of mushroom, I guess, tea. I'm not sure what hallucinogenic. But it leads to I remember that it's been speculated for a long time, not speculated, but revealed that Patton Oswalt had some kind of cameo role this season.
Yeah.
And this is it. This is it. When he's on this, mushroom tea, he's listening to the Goo Goo Dolls and suddenly his gills start talking to him.
Mm-hmm. I love it.
And he breaks through a lot of shit. You know, like how far this goes back and how self-conscious he is about his mutation and what people think about it and how, I mean, none of this stuff excuses people for their maladaptive behaviors, but it's interesting that they explore the space of like his humiliating and threatening women comes from a place of fear of humiliation and being made small himself.
So I don't know if the psychology first.
Yeah, I don't know if the psychology and all that kind of checks out, but thematically it works for the character, where now he has to come to grips of what he feels about himself and the ugliness that he has inside, so that he can, you know, be as beautiful and as attractive to people and as good of a person as he clearly wants to be.
Yeah. And I don't, is it this episode or is it next episode where they're singing together?
It's this episode.
You are so beautiful.
And that's the thing, is like, this really threads the needle and walks that tightrope between being just irredeemably ridiculous and kind of profound and meaningful. And I felt like that song at the end was just the right balance of like bittersweet, but also just ridiculous, you know?
Oh, yeah. No, I liked it. I like what they're... This carries over into next episode too, because they're still like, they're going to put him right back on this train. And I guess the question is, how is he going to deal with it? Because in the next episode, you know, he comes in to try and save the day with the whale. And the first thing that happens once that whale gets done in, Homelander lands and says, "Your gills are showing, cover them up. They're disgusting." Right. So like, this is not just internal, but it's also external. And I think that's going to be an interesting thing that they're going to say about this, is like, it all feeds back into each other, right?
Yeah, for sure. So there, that's the comic relief for the episode. Maeve is interesting backstory. They reveal that she is a lesbian. Mm-hmm. She had a lover that she cared a lot about, but she broke things off and kind of went cold turkey on her because she was terrified at another one of these manufactured relationships for the media. And she got into one with Homelander, and she tells this horrifying story of being at an Oscar party where a Hollywood producer like pulled some rank and to have her sit next to him and flirted with him. And then they found his head detached from his body a few days later. And apparently Homelander's the one that did the detaching. It's interesting because there's so many questions I have. Like, is this a sham relationship from Homelander's perspective too? Or did they have some kind of sexual relationship that she was forced to do, which is horrifying? Or was it like he didn't care about her, but he didn't want to be publicly humiliated by being cucked by this Hollywood producer? And there's like so many different fucked up flavors to this relationship, and I wonder if we'll know more. But it's like Maeve becomes more and more a tragic character, that she goes into this thing kind of like Starlight, wanting to do the right thing, and it ends up consuming her life and perverting her into something that she never wanted to be, or like a twisted funhouse version, evil funhouse version of what she wanted to be.
No, it's super interesting because I'm not exactly sure where Homelander and Maeve are at right now. Like, because, you know, they're trying to now pair Homelander off with Annie, with Starlight, in maybe like a relationship type of way. I don't know. But there's a scene where Maeve is like, she gets a call. This might be next episode, but it's all of a piece.
I know what you're talking about.
From her ex, and Homelander walks into the room right as she's like hanging up. And there's this tension in the scene where like, you think Homelander's like this mousetrap where you're like tapping the cheese constantly, not intentionally, but like you're rubbing up against the cheese, and you never quite know if the mousetrap is ready to spring on you or if it's like it knows that you're rubbing on the cheese and it's just waiting to get you at the worst possible moment or what. Like he's there's something in his eyes where he's like constantly either knowing or suspicious, and I can't tell which it is. And Maeve is like playing it as like innocent, but also knowing that he knows something else is going on
but
here.
She can't reveal that because then the trap slams shut on her.
Yeah, I I don't know what it is, but it's really like this tightrope dance that they're doing.
Well,
it's,
the other thing is, good. I don't know if Homelander has super hearing or not. Have they? Because
or if
like
he needs
Superman
to, like, focus it
right
intentionally, because, or if he just hears everything.
Yeah, because if Superman walks in his room, I assume he's heard both ends of the conversation.
Right. Right. Right.
So like, there's enough doubt there, especially when we get to episode 3, because there's a couple things that just wouldn't happen if he has super duper hearing. So maybe that's just something he doesn't have.
Yeah.
But I don't know. You're right. There's that crackle with every scene where anyone's got something, a hidden agenda, which in this show is everyone,
right,
is dealing with Homelander because none of the seven can stand up to him. No one on Earth, as far as I know, can. And he's completely paranoid. He is power tripping. He's also mm-hmm. deeply insecure in fundamental ways. And that's just a fucking terrifying situation to be in.
Yeah, I also like what they're doing with Maeve and her ex, from a standpoint of like lying to people for their own good, because Huey's doing the same with Annie throughout these episodes. And I think,
right,
you know, like I said, the themes of like family that they have with the boys and being part of the group, and Butcher being kind of like the subversion of that, but also this other theme of like lying to people for their own good. They're roping characters in large groups into themes that they're playing on here. And it's working.
I agree. And I think it works a lot better with Maeve, because you've got the superhero trying to protect the mortal, which I think works a lot better. And we're conditioned to know, like, Peter Parker has a secret identity, so the Aunt May and MJ doesn't get hurt. And, you know, Clark Kent is around so that Superman can have a normal relationship and not have fucking, you know, Darkseid come and kill Lois Lane and Jimmy Olsen. So it works a lot better when you have a super person trying to take care of a mortal and stand between them and, you know, essentially a villain in Homelander.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it works pretty good. Shall we move on to like the Starlight A-Train show? Because I really liked some of these behind the scenes mundane like sketch of a day in the life of a hero, where they got to do all these network affiliate reads. Like,
girls get
it done. Couple hundred in a day. Every local affiliate station, you know, San Diego, Sandusky, Albuquerque, like they all have like a little thing, and I thought that was great. And that the Starlight and Stormfront and Maeve are supposed to do this press junket because it's the women, and the showing the how, you know, anytime you it's amazing how rare it is that a star just snaps at one of these, because they do a very good job of showing how fucking inane it is that every single person from every single outlet, from the giant ones to, you know, the little podcasts and blogs, come in and they think they're asking their phenomenally interesting question, and it's always the same goddamn thing.
Yeah.
Which is one of the things it's funny, because like realizing that has kind of turned me off trying to interview celebrities, because it's really hard to come up with like a unique, interesting spin on their life that you can think of to ask, that they haven't been asked a million times. And you know, it's super fun when you do that, but holy shit, it's a one in a million shot. But I loved all this kind of just like, you know, TMZ style shit that they were doing.
And then, you know, Stormfront doing her like Facebook Live, Instagram, whatever she's
Periscope,
she's on TikTok, whatever. Yeah, doing that stuff at the same time was really cool too.
And talking shit about her own action figure and saying, don't buy this, this is going to be in a landfill. I thought that was cool.
And she's got a great scene later in this episode, the Pippi Longstocking scene.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about that? Because I also want to, what is the purpose? Why ambush Starlight with A-Train? Or do you think A-Train engineered that?
Wait, what are you talking about?
Well, A-Train is in a hospital on a ventilator, the last time we saw him in the last episode. And this episode, like, you know, they're in the middle of the junket, and the E! Hollywood Access News TMZ person says, you've been keeping a prayer side vigil by his bed. It's like, what would you think if he was here right now? And sonic boom, he comes in and he's like, hey, I'm A-Train, everybody. Like, why did Vought? I'm trying to think of, like, mechanically, did Vought do that to try to figure out what Starlight's loyalty,
but it's so weird because like this is a girls get it done event, right? Like this is supposed to be the girls,
But Maeve dipped out.
Maeve leaves, but then A-Train shows up. It's very strange. You're right.
So did he just wake up that day and Vought's like, hey, we need an extra... Or is it something that A-Train wanted to do because he wanted to like get in there before Homelander or Vought got involved and like get their story straight? Because that's largely what they do in this episode.
Yeah, yeah.
Like they kind of feel each other out. What do you know? What do I know? What are you going to say? What are the stakes?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know who arranged that, but it did feel strange.
Yeah, it's maybe a little writerly with that, but it's, I don't know. I like the I like the sleight of hand with the V and how Gecko slid it to her in like a tampon case. That was pretty funny. And Starlight showing she's got some sleight of hand skills that I'm not sure where she picked up, but she's good at it.
And her, you know, getting the pep talk from Stormfront about how she needs to not give a shit what people think about her. Because Pippi Longstocking would bite a D, that's for damn sure.
Yeah, it's, did you? Because I remember back when I was in school, we read some Pippi Adventures of Pippi Longstocking. So I was somewhat familiar with the character, but I did not remember her as a hero, like a superhero. Like maybe I just don't remember it, but she's almost seems like an adolescent Popeye, female redheaded Popeye. You know, okay. She's like super strong or something like that. But I didn't remember that aspect of her. Maybe she ate some radioactive spinach at some point in a later adventure that I wasn't privy to, and she's super powered. But I don't know. It's also weird her, when we find out about Stormfront in the next episode, it's weird her like fuck the world for confusing nice with good. Because she's neither.
No, she's not.
And so like, is she playing? What is she doing with Starlight? She's accusing her of being a phony and not being a real hero and blah, blah, blah. But she's doing the same. She's keeping up the same front. I don't know. Maybe that's part of her front, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing she is not is a toe the line, you know, corporate stooge. She's going to do whatever the fuck she wants to do. Casualties are not a problem for her. She doesn't care about quotas. She doesn't care about image that Vought wants her to portray. Like, I feel like she's not a hypocrite in telling her, like, don't give a shit what people think about you. But she's also, I don't know if she thinks she's good and nice, or good and not nice, rather. Or if she just says this for some ulterior motive. But, like, she's, like you said, neither. I don't know what her definition of nice or good is.
Well, and also, like, that's the, you know, one of the fucked up things is, like, these, like, really... Like deeply racist characters a lot of times think they are, you know, saving the world from a Jewish conspiracy to dilute the superior race's blood and drag them down. And if that was like literally happening, if there's some insidious like lizard, you know, like if you had the lizards from V trying to fuck with humanity by doing this, that, and the other, like, you know, the hero of the story would be the people fighting that. But what, that's just a bullshit fiction. But I guess under that framework, maybe she could see is like, well, you know, me telling the truth to powers, including like race realism and talking about IQs and what are we going to do? What's the question about the Jews? And so I guess
what's like, her definition of good? I don't know.
Yeah. Like the fucking Nazi flunkies thought they were saving the world, too. So and her name's Stormfront. So we'll talk about that in the next episode. What else have we cleaned up this one pretty good? This episode? Do you got any other points you want to make?
No, I think I'm good. Let's move on to number three, Over the Hill with the Swords of a Thousand Men. I had no idea what this meant. It's a very specific title, and it doesn't seemingly have anything to do with the episode. Did you find out anything about this?
Yeah, I did. I did some research, and apparently this is a punk rock song from the 80s out of the UK that I'd never heard of before, but it looks like it's a kind of like, you know, a punk rock drinking fighting song. And it's a fight about, it's set in medieval times, and it's literally like people in a castle getting loaded, getting hammered and smashed and getting themselves worked up to go out in a battle, and then they go and they fight and then they win.
Okay.
So it's kind of like Chumbawamba tub thumping only with 1,000 swords.
Perfect.
that kind of same kind of energy.
Well, I like the music they're using better than that. So
yeah. Mostly they've done good use of music this season. I thought like the first episode, Under Pressure, opening and closing with Huey feeling that. I thought that was pretty mm-hmm. good.
The Billy Joel was a little confusing until we got to this episode, and then I was like, okay.
Yeah, right. When I fired this up, I thought, well, something's gone wrong on the Amazon databases. Something's right. misingested. I've got this like old, it felt like an old Mentos commercial starting up, and uh-huh. what the hell, Billy Joel? And this, also, I did some research into this Second Wind song.
You're Only Human.
And yeah. You're Only Human. Because it's this weird upbeat song about don't kill yourself, man. Things are going to get okay. It's going to be okay. And I'm like, what the fuck is going on? Apparently, Billy Joel had a lot of suicidal ideation that he got through and overcame
with
some dark periods of his time. And he wanted to write this to like tell other young people that like you should never give up because you never know what will happen later on in life. Yeah. But two things happened. One of his bandmates made ruthless fun of the title Second Wind, which is why it got changed to You're Only Human. And then he also like wrote the music to a much more somber soundtrack. But then he thought like, well, this is actually even more depressing. So he changed it up to have like an upbeat pop. But it just, I love you, Billy. But yeah, I don't know that the tonal whiplash crash. Like, imagine Phil Collins in the Air tonight, only it's an upbeat pop number. Because I think that's what you got here. You got a suicidal person dressed in a clown suit, mm-hmm. and that's what this song is. And it's just like it's uncanny valley business. And the video. Okay,
the video
so
is
I read
like
the
dancing
interview.
On the edge of this. What is it?
I read the interview with Billy Joel where he explains about all this stuff, but then it's like, well, yeah, okay, fine. But having said all this, then you went on stage, shot this video. So, well, come on. I don't know. Maybe. if everyone had a harmonica playing Billy Joel show up right before they jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge, no one would do it. And mm-hmm. that's the lesson of the story. It's giving Huey life in this episode.
Right.
Because he's in a really dark place. He's in a really dark place with Butcher.
Yeah,
Butcher just whipped his ass.
Well, he was in a really dark place with Robin. You know, like after Robin was killed, like he went
right.
He spiraled down, man. And then I feel like it was when he found Annie. You know, that's the second win. It's exactly what he's saying here. It's like, yeah, he could have just like given up then. But he's starting to feel like he's got something to fight for again.
Yeah, and I like how they've got this. The boys never feel safe. Like they're out here in this boat in like semi international waters, and all they got to do is wait for a couple hours for their CIA handlers to come out here and take possession of this terrorist. And it's like, what could be easier? They've essentially won. But Frenchie's horny for Kimiko, and he lets slip a Red Bull that this guy's able to get a finger out of the thing, and then the NYPD somehow get a hard on for finding this boat and are able to track it down, which I thought like, wow, I guess that's the thing. Like if someone stole my boat, I would never, ever get any, you know, I got a $1,500 12-foot sailboat. You steal a $50 million yacht, NYPD will actually, you know, do some police work and maybe get on the radar and work with the Coast Guard to find your ass.
Yeah.
And that's what's exactly happened. But it's just like always like, this one damn thing happens after another. The super terrorist gets out, tries to kill Billy. Then the FBI show up. The NYPD show up. They get splashed. Aquaman joins in the party. It's just like, I don't know. There's something that tickles me about them never being safe. And just when you think they're winning, they're losing.
Yeah. And it doesn't end there, right? Like they go into this drain pipe. They're running for their lives. You got Homelander on your ass now. It's frightening. I do really enjoy like the pacing of the show. I think they constantly keep it moving, and you know, as one door is closing behind them, another is opening in front of them, and they never, even when they, you know, go out to Sandusky and they're dealing with the deep stuff, I don't feel like that stuff is unwarranted. I always feel like it's coming back, and it does in this episode, right? Like in the most spectacular way possible. We always have like a dolphin scene or in this case, a whale scene where they just drive this fucking boat right into the whale. And then in boys fashion, they don't just do it and it's done. They do it and they literally sit in it for a while and let you view the carnage from the inside out. It's incredible.
And they went for broke on the practical. I mean, everything about this is cool because, like, I think it started happening like Batman Brave and the Bold animated series where, like, Aquaman's public image started to be rehabilitated. And now it's kind of like weird to think of Aquaman as a weak dude since Jason Momoa started playing him and he's got 38 inch biceps and he's like essentially Superman except for underwater. And he can talk you can see the tear, like, you know, if you have a whole pack of killer whale after a boat, that's pretty intimidating. And they have the deep where he's like on top of this sperm whale and he does this cool fishtail onto the beach and like blocks him off their escape path. And he strikes the heroic pose with the music swelling behind him. And this, at this point, it's like, it's exactly like a standalone Aquaman adventure against some eco-terrorist or whatever. And then it takes a left turn at the Boysville.
Yeah.
With Butcher getting this demented look on his face and just shoving the boat's engine full throttle and impaling this whale. And as soon as I saw it, like, I'm like, wow, they really went all in on this practical whale effect just to have these guys scramble out of it. But then I realized that, no, they're not done. Like you said, they're going to live in this whale for a couple good couple of minutes. Have some.
Yeah.
Hearts to hearts by the still slowly dying, beating whale heart that they're standing next to. God, it's this is why you love the show. You never in a million years. Like, this is some Deadpool shit that they get up to.
There's just nothing like it on TV. The Boys is willing to go to the extremes in violence and like this comic violence that's like, I'm not even disgusted by it because it's just meant to be funny. I don't know. I've not really seen anything like this outside of really schlocky horror films. And so like this tonal clash of like these good guys who are supposed to be good guys, but they're bad guys. And then they're also causing extreme violence and gore. I just love it.
I want to talk about this thing going on the A-Train. It started the last episode too. The fact that he's having, are these miniature heart attacks? Are these panic attacks? Are these V withdrawals he's going through? What is your take on his performance failure / health condition?
Yeah, seems like it's a heart thing to me. It's just overloading his cardiovascular system from all this V.
Do you think there is something? Because I thought maybe it was a V withdrawal because he's trying, like, I don't think he can get V anymore because, you know, his girlfriend that he murdered last season was his supplier, right?
So yeah, I hadn't considered that.
Because, you know, the fact that he was kind of slowing down a tick anyway, and he's still using his powers, and now he's not taking it. Like, is this kind of like we're going to be treated into like a heroin withdrawal type of plot line with this guy getting clean and sober?
I guess I was just assuming it was a follow on from last season when he was overdosing essentially on this stuff. But it could be the inverse now. Like, he could be, you know, coming down hard.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Big question mark I had on that. We also get something in when Butcher's on the boat and he's talking to the CIA lady, the colonel. She asks him about an old suit named Liberty.
Mm-hmm.
You got anything on that?
Nothing.
That's just I mean, I imagine if you've read the comic books, it probably, because you might know something. But I was wondering if that was something that rang any particular bell and how it would, or if it's just right now just something you're supposed to notice as a clue, perhaps a red herring, but maybe. That's definitely something my ears picked up on.
Yeah, I think they're setting something up.
There's also, I really like there's some interesting thematic and foreshadowing work they're doing with Kimiko and her brother, that, you know, she talks about like, hey, I'm your big sister and I'm watching out for you and I'm always the one saving you. And he's like, actually, you remember that one time where you stole food out of the food closet and I took the punishment for it and they broke my hands? Then this episode that has a greater fulfillment when Stormfront breaks his hands and then Kimiko is able to get away clean. So he's saved her once again.
Yeah.
And it's a truly tragic story.
And you can see the anger and hatred in her eyes when she's seeing Stormfront getting all that press at the end for saving the day, right?
Oh, yeah. And the other thing that's interesting is that she can't fully trust Butcher and his team, because her ears are fine. That's the other thing they revealed in this episode when the brother had the heart-to-heart with Frenchie, is that she's psychologically mute. Mm-hmm. She stopped talking when her parents were killed in front of them, and they developed this like custom twin sign language. That means that when she came down the staircase and heard Butcher finishing up with the phone call with the lady and saying that, like, oh, if she turns rogue, I can eliminate her, she heard that. It's not like she's deaf. So right. She's kind of a woman without a country right now, or at least fully a home.
Yeah. Yeah. If she didn't already feel uncomfortable enough around the guy who was trying to murder her brother. Yeah. I could see it.
There's also an interesting bit. What'd you make of Huey getting all this kudos from Mother and Frenchie for, you know, putting a legitimate thorn in Vought's side?
Yeah.
You know, I felt like Huey seemed like a real dipshit that he has to like he wants Butcher to give him a kiss on both cheeks for doing this, even though he put his wife's, you know, life in danger. Like I felt like Huey, it felt uncharacteristic for even Huey, but even for Mother and Frenchie to be that all in on like, yeah, man, you said nice one. You should do something more. You should get him like a fucking gift certificate to Applebee's or something. Like there should be some more recognition here. It's like, what? I was kind of on Butcher's side and I don't usually feel that way. Like what the fuck? Really good one then.
I mean, yeah, that's the question. Like, I don't know what he's going to do in this moment, right? Like, high five him, celebrate with him. But that's not Butcher. That's not the guy he is. I mean, maybe they know something about Butcher and his past, and he used to be this guy who could celebrate a win, even when it wasn't his own win. But, like, I don't know. Butcher, you know, that doesn't get him any closer to where he wants to be with his family, right? Becca. And I feel like that's the thing that's on his mind. And so when he's like, nice one, he's congratulating him for the win, for like MM's win, right? Because MM might be able to go back to his family sooner than he thought. But yeah, I don't know what he's supposed to do in this moment. But also, I get the sentiment. Like, we're all celebrating here and high-fiving and chest-bumping. Why aren't you doing that with us? Because this is a win for all of us. I don't know. Nobody's wrong here. It's just nobody's 100% right either.
No, it's frustrating because the other thing is, I think if Butcher sees the downside, is like, well, now we've got an even bigger target on our back because you did this with Starlight, which means you're connected to us, which means we're going to be, you know, minor inconvenience to like maybe public enemy number one pretty soon, which is something that like Mother connects those dots too. Like he mentions that like, you know, you doing this with Starlight is going to get her killed because if she's not careful and she comes under the watchful eye of Homelander, she's fucked. And Homelander being who he is, like I thought that's something they did really effectively in the first episode. Like he does this like supersonic flyby that like shocks like Huey and has him put his hood up because he could be anywhere. He could be everywhere. Mm-hmm. Does he have supervision? Is he like Brandon Roth where he can just go into low Earth orbit and close his eyes and know instinctively where the Huey could be if he wanted to? Like it's terrifying. So like, I'm glad that you brought Vought down, but also we're trying to do some personal shit for ourselves and you're not telling anybody that you're doing this and you're kind of doing it on your own and you want an attaboy for it.
Yeah.
Also,
that complicates it.
First three episodes, funniest Butcher quote ever. The whole like, I'll tell you what, when all this is over, I'll buy you a big bucket of top shelf lube and I'll tickle your balls until you beg me to stop. But then I won't. I just won't do it. It cracks me up, man. It's been that quote's been getting a lot of play in our house the last few days.
It's great.
But I don't know. This is the episode where like I felt like all the boys kind of got on each other's bad side. Like Butcher's on the outs because he alienated Huey. Frenchie's on the outs because he's thinking with his dick and almost got everybody killed. Mm-hmm. Mother's kind of on the outs because he's sticking up for Huey, which pisses off Butcher. But he makes this case that, Huey's your emotional canary, which what do you think about that?
I mean, Huey's, I think that's right. I think you see it in this and several other episodes, you know, like when you've gone too far, they're not talking about like when you've, you know, pursued the case too far, or gone to the wrong lead. They're talking about when you've emotionally broken everyone around you. Right. Like that's the thing. Huey's the most sensitive of them, but you know, MM and Frenchie are not that far behind. So if he falls, that's the first domino, and you should be looking at yourself and going, okay, maybe I'm pushing too hard.
Yeah. And, you know, everyone's got stakes now. You know, Huey's got his relationship with Starlight. Mother's got his relationship with his family. Frenchie's got his relationship. Well, I'm not even sure if it's a relationship with Kimiko. Does Kimiko even aware that he's hot for her?
I think so, yeah.
How does she feel about him? Like, indifferent?
Yeah.
Everyone got these stakes that they're afraid to lose things, and Butcher acts like he's kind of the only one, and I think that act is running as bad as the team feels for him, and as much as they all hate Homelander, the premise of his mission was starting to piss everyone off, and I thought there's a hint at the end of this episode where he takes a look at, you know, this tabletop menu that he scratched all these details on before he forgot them, and he folds it up and kind of puts it back in a cigar box. I think that's the way this episode's way of telling us that Butcher's going to be more of a team player now.
Yeah.
He's not forgetting about what he needs to do with Becca, but keeping everyone else safe and getting everyone else back to there has to be something he plays more than just lip service for. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is I think you're supposed to realize through the lens of his discussion with the colonel, where he shows up at that funeral and he lays his big guilt trip on her about, like, oh, you know, do it for Rainer. And she's like, fuck you, Billy. You don't give a shit about Rainer. All you want is you're fucked and you're in an impossible position and you need me and you're using me. I don't think that Mother and Frenchie and Huey had made that connection yet, but I think that's what he was doing in him putting the menu away, I think, is the show saying that he's going to try, you know, like you said, fake leveling last time. He's actually going to try to be a little bit more honest and straightforward and respect team more.
Yeah, whether he can actually do that, you know, get over the personality he currently has and change that is yet to be seen. Yeah. I don't like his chances, let's just say.
Yeah, me either. It's interesting to see how they're going to keep the deep Twitter-pated with the Scientology cult because, you know, L. Ron Hubbard called and said that this is his ticket into the Seven, and it blows up in a spectacular fashion. Not only does Homelander just give him superficial reassurance, oh, yeah, sure, buddy, we'll get you right back on the Seven. Oh, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Oh, we already have Seven, sorry. But he also body shames him, like brings back all the worst stuff.
Yeah.
And this mission has been an epic failure in a very psychologically devastating way to him. Are they going to get him to come back to the Elrond table or what?
Yeah, I wonder if he's going to just change his mind on even wanting to be in the Seven. Because, like, I talked about that feedback loop, right, where, like, the external becomes the internal and vice versa. So, like, he might just decide, look, Homelander and the body shaming that is the overt body shaming here is what's causing or at least feeding back into the problems I already have. So, like, I don't need it. I don't want it. Like, the Seven is cool, but me being a whole human being is cooler. I don't know.
I guess they could just dispose of the deep at this point.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's expendable. But certainly.
I'm not sure. I was just thinking, like, I'm not sure what the fascination for the Church of the Center or whatever, the Scientology's stand-in is. But then I realized that's one of Scientology's big things, is they do recruit high-profile A-listers to make themselves look good. Tom Cruise and others.
And others, yeah.
John Travolta. Yeah, John Travolta and the many others that are in Scientology publicly. But yeah, like, they've got like this low tier guy and they're using him to try to get to the next tier.
And yeah, it's working, right? Where do you go from the deep? Can you get, I don't know. Does he have friends? He doesn't have friends. So I don't know where they go from there, but you know, you gain clout with every hero you bring.
You go from the deep and he recruits Shamu. And you work your way up to Flipper, and now you got something.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Willie's next.
I like Homelander's increasing exasperation with everyone on his team. Like last episode, I don't know if it's real or not, but he talks about, you know, you and me, Maeve, we're the rock, we're blah blah blah. But like he's tired of A-Train and his performance failures and that kind of bullshit. He's over the deep. And now he's got a grudge against, well, then he finds out that Starlight is on some level still fucking with this Huey guy, was going to force her to kill him. And I'm like, man, how are they going to get out of this? when Kimiko's brother drops a literal subway on top of him. But then Stormfront goes rogue and disobeys a direct order from Homelander to save the super terrorist for him, causes massive collateral damage, kills every minority that she can get her hands on, throws a couple ethnic slurs, tears this guy's arms off, and then plays the good guy in front of the press conference and uses the this, you know, like, oh, we're not the real heroes, let's give it up for the first responders, turns her back to clap. And the only reason she did that is so she could shine Homelander on. Is she another in the Stan Edgar class where it's like, is she sure? Are we sure she knows what she's doing? Like, yeah, she's powerful, but is she Homelander powerful? Because she gives no fucks about shitting on his movie ideas, not giving him the full credit that he craves, challenging his leadership, challenging his personal power. Like, is she way more powerful than we think?
It's that's a damn good question. It's like the number one question I had coming out of this episode about her. Like, what does she want out of this relationship? Because she has, she's clearly fucking with Homelander. And I can't tell if that's just like, she generally fucks with people. She doesn't give a shit about what people think about her. And so that comes across as being a bitch or fucking with people, manipulative, whatever. But then I look at why she would want to be in the Seven, if that's the case. Why does she care about the Seven? Well, you know, maybe she's a Stan Edgar appointee, but also what's in it for her? And I don't think these are questions with answers yet, but I'm looking forward to the rest of the season, seeing how that plays out, because there's a power dynamic here and there's a motivational dynamic that I don't quite understand yet.
If I squint, I can see a little bit of Madeline with this, that she, because she's also kind of flirtatious with him at the big, you know, when Stan Edgar goes, you know what, I don't go down to the 99th floor often enough, and you guys are valuable, blah, 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 and Homelander gives the whole we're family and fuck Vought and all that kind of stuff, and she expresses approval, but with a very kind of flirtatious, kind of intriguing, and I wonder if she's trying, because Edgar's put her up to it, or because this is something she somehow learned in her investigations of the Seven, because she, you know, she knew enough to call bullshit on all their fakey, you know, being out there with the troops bullshit.
Yeah.
But I wonder if she's trying to set up that kind of like weird psychosexual love hate relationship, that it's essentially she's a superpowered Madeline.
Could be.
And she sees that as, you know, her way into ingratiating herself in a group. I don't know, but it's like, Mr. Edgar, it's a fucking dangerous game you're playing with him.
The more dangerous, the better the game, in my opinion, when it comes to television. So bring it on.
Yeah. What do we think of Homelander and his kid? Because when he dumped the kid off the roof, I kind of thought like this kid might be dead. And this was going to make, you know, once the fascination of the kid's not there, then Becca's like super vulnerable. But I mean, no,
this is a dangerous game for everybody. Like, okay, Homelander and his son together teamed up could be fucking the worst nightmare the Earth has ever seen. It could also be that the kid is Homelander's worst nightmare. Like, Homelander's not looking far enough ahead and saying, oh boy, if I turn this kid into a monster, the monster might eventually fucking Frankenstein me, right? Like, this shit could get dangerous for me because it's the only force on the planet that could possibly challenge me.
We talked about that in the preview, how Homelander is so arrogant that he can't conceive of him fucking around a V causing something that's greater than him that he can't oppose, or that his progeny could outdo him, be more powerful than him. He sees that as something, like you said, Luke Skywalker, Vader. Well, what happens when, you know, Luke chops off your arm and joins the Emperor?
Yeah.
Joins Stan Edgar. Or, oh shit, maybe that's what Stan Edgar's hoping for. That, like, if Homelander fucks with this kid, that he can call on this kid to rein his old man in at some point.
Yeah, I mean, the game has changed now that Homelander knows about the kid. So he's going to have to, if he doesn't have a plan for that, he's going to have to develop one real quick.
Yeah, that's interesting. But I don't know, that whole impassioned speech about where Homelander, because like, How much of the Seven knows what a bastard he is? Like, does the Seven have an open secret with each other? Because I felt like that him and Translucent and Maeve all had an understanding, and A-Train and even the Deep. And but yeah, it's weird because in this boardroom, when he's opposing Stan Edgar, it's very much like, you know, companies come and go, talent is forever. Let's go out there and take this terrorist down because we're heroes and that's what we do. It's a very... like something you do for public consumption. Is he playing for Stormfront and Starlight because he doesn't know about how cool they're with? He hasn't co-opted them yet, or like,
I'm not sure if he's playing
rah-rah for
because there might be two guys and they all know the two different guys. Like Homelander, when he's for Homelander, is just a bastard. But also Homelander is the leader of the Seven, and the Seven as a unit is everyone, you know, and they're perceived as a certain thing. And so he's talking not about like, oh, this will benefit us all individually, but also it kind of does, because it benefits the collective that is the Seven. And, you know, we've got a public image to uphold. I don't know. I mean, certainly I don't think they're in on him, you know, spreading Compound V around the world to create super T's, soup T's. I think like, I don't know. I don't know. Like, I don't think they've shown us enough about their relationship to know exactly how the other bunch of the Seven feel about him. You know, it's still like something they're exploring, and I'm okay going along this journey with them.
Plus, we got two new members, so that's kind of already in flux anyway. You know, speaking of this messaging we're talking about, I thought it was interesting how they set up Homelander, that he's got like some keen insights about how people feel about heroes. Like they had this, I'm not sure if it's this episode or last one, where they have this focus group where they're talking about, do you like super terrorist? No, that makes me, well, how about super villain? Oh, that's much better. And that's the thing that he's been stumping for. But then they say, you know, together we protect the world versus together we protect America. The public liked the world, the more global, inclusive one. But Homelander said, nah, they're wrong. What are they telling us about his instincts? Are his instincts good, or does he have blind spots, or is he got the ability to shape personal opinion? Because I think, and then what is he? That's the other thing. Is like, what does he care about personal opinion? Like, what does he care about money, fame, all that kind of stuff? Or is that something where like Homelander is starting, or they're telling the story of Homelander realizing like, why am I doing any of this stuff? Why don't I just rule everyone like a god?
It certainly could be telling the beginnings of that story. Feels like it.
I'm just gonna General Zod. Everyone kneel before me. Starting with the U.S. president, I'm gonna get everyone kneeling and kissing the ring, and then I'm just gonna be a god, and you guys will do that. Like it's so weird because his ambition seems crazy lofty, but also somewhat petty and pointless for a person with as much power as he apparently has.
Yeah, no, that's a good question, and it seems like his work spreading Compound V is the exact antithesis of being the god that he wants to be, because he's creating other gods. I don't know. Maybe he sees that as some like power trip too, being able to create other supervillains. But yeah, I don't know, man, this guy is so messed up. I don't know what he's thinking at any given moment, really.
When Homelander demands that Starlight kills Huey, does Starlight do that? Like, if Butcher doesn't show up and drop a subway on him.
The only other option here is for her to turn her powers on Homelander, and I don't think that goes well.
I don't think so either, but again, I'm not quite sure, because they haven't revealed any weakness of Homelander so far, and I'm curious to see what, you know, this goes into the whole conversation we had about Stan Edgar. Is he on V? Is there an anti-V that you can get, like, they can put in some breast milk to get this guy to ingest it so that it depowers him? Like, what is the thing that's going to put Homelander in check? And I just don't see it.
I'll say I feel like I would be a little disappointed if they went with an anti-V, if they went with a kryptonite. It seems a little too simple, a little too easy. It changes the equation in a way that I don't like.
Yeah,
because I want to see the natural consequences of dealing with a superhuman being like this, when you don't have the advantage of some crippling rock or something that you can just string around his neck and throw him in a pool. That's too easy.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. But on the other hand, when you're doing this much subversion, sometimes playing its trope straight could be useful too. But I guess it depends on, you know, what they do with it.
Yeah.
I do love the exchange between Billy and Homelander when he's like, oh, I had a great breakfast with your wife this morning. She made pancakes. They were delicious. And he does, Anthony Starr does this crazy tongue thing in the middle of delicious. I don't know how you do it. My tongue's not that, I'm not superpowered. But it's like so fucking gross and funny at the same time.
Yeah, that dude, he's spectacular in this.
Yeah. And also they had this little throwaway scene where the corporate lawyers are like losing their shit as Edgar's kind of like pondering things. And they're saying like, you know, there's a high risk, high reward strategy of denying everything. But if we're found out, it can be 10 times worse. We all go to jail, or we can just mea culpa and blah, blah, blah. Well, at the end of the episode, Mr. Edgar goes all in on the deny. It's a small
He does both.
Team of disaffect.
Personally denies. Yeah. But then casts the blame, you know, mea culpas on the organization, right? Like
the small group of disaffected scientists led by the rogue VP Madeline. Yeah.
Yeah. Throwing and a dead person under the bus, scapegoating her. Yeah. It's
pinning all the deaths that Stormfront caused on the super terrorists. Yeah. There's going to be that's all going to be interesting to see how this plays out. I really enjoyed the deeps. He's talking about getting weepy with his Scientology auditor. And he's like, you know, I started when I was a kid and I went into a pet store and the goldfish were all begging for their lives. And then we went to Red Lobster. And
yeah,
I just thought that was pretty low stakes, stupid shit to have him say. Mm-hmm. I also noticed in all three of these episodes, they had this kind of like Alexandria Focasia Cortez kind of like lookalike. This young congresswoman who's calling bullshit on the system and expressing deep skepticism about American adventurers overseas, and also that the getting cozier and cozier with the supers in the military. I wonder if she's going to be lasered down in a private plane like we saw with the senator that kind of opposed the merger last season, or what they're building her up to be.
Yeah,
because they keep on, you know, like there's a couple of these things that keep coming up in the little background TV things, these background elements that I think are going to be important later on. So I'm keeping my eye on her. But yeah, I guess most of the other stuff is like, I want to discuss how they might keep Homelander in check, but I think we've done all that.
I think his kid's going to be a key to that.
Yeah. And the Stormfront, like, if you didn't get what I was talking about, you know, Stormfront is the name of the leading like newsletter, e-zine, forum site for neo-Nazis online. And Portland has been kind of a bit of a, you know, Portland has this reputation of being insanely liberal, but Oregon as a state is pretty red, and there's a lot of people in the surrounding neighborhoods and surrounds of Portland that have had enough of that shit, and it's kind of a hotbed of super right wing like different organizations, and you're seeing that come to a head in the protests and stuff, where increasingly it seems like it's protesters versus and rioters versus, you know, Proud Boys and militia types, with the cops kind of like cracking down on the one and turning a blind eye to the other. So pretty broad and on the nose, but also current and relevant. I'm very curious to see.
Yeah, there's no way they could have been influenced by current events, because that's just
right.
Like,
plus, this book was written
filming
years
before
ago,
the whole protest stuff happened. So
yeah, and I think Stormfront is in the comic books, and the comic books have been out for a couple of years. So, but the Stormfront Portland, that stuff's been brewing. If you've been paying attention to the kind of stuff, has been brewing for several years now. So it's just kind of happy coincidence, sad coincidence, depressing coincidence that it's like coming to a head right as the boys are coming out here. But I'm curious to see what they do with her as a, because on the surface, it's, I don't know, kind of one note, one dimensional to have like a person who seems like they're super nice and progressive and whatnot, but they're secretly a Nazi.
Yeah.
You know, what can you do with that? There's no daylight to really run right on Homelander for crazy. So you just make, but that's things like, I feel like Homelander's probably racist. He's certainly ableist.
I mean, but the race that he's racist against is the entirety of humanity, like
that's
the
true.
Non-soups, right? Like, really,
mortals.
Even all the soups too, just not himself.
Anyone that's not a god,
right?
He's against. Yeah, you're right. He's racist against the human race.
Yeah,
it's a good way to put it. But there you go. I don't know. There's a. I thought it was really enigmatic, the performance Anthony Starr is giving about Stormfront, because when she says, "Well, you snooze, you lose, Gramps," and there's this long shot of him building into frustration, rage, impotence, arousal. Like, there's a little bit of all that stuff going in with him, and he's just so good at playing this fucking super psychopath.
Yeah.
That's about all that I got. Do you got anything else for this? These triplets of episodes?
No, man, I'm good.
I feel like I fought a army with 1,000 swords at the end of this.
Mm-hmm.
But now this thing is like, I've been waiting for a whole fucking week. I've been in the position of the listener waiting to plow into episode 4 of The Boys, and I can do it now that we're done with the podcast.
Only 4, not 5.
I got it. Like, yeah.
That's the thing. I just want to binge this whole freaking season. And I, you know, kudos on Amazon for not putting it out that way, because they certainly could have. And they've done that with past shows like The Expanse. And I think it just kills all the conversation that happens around it, all of the fun that we have as fans, you know. Questioning, like, what are Stormfront's motivations? What's Homelander gonna do? Well, we would know all that shit if they just dropped it, and it's just boring to do it that way.
Yeah, and for the sake of the podcast, we are going to restrain ourselves and do things week to week before we record things, because we don't want to get ahead and be accused of having formed speculation and whatnot. But if you've got some thoughts about the episode or some thoughts about the season coming on ahead, just keep in mind that Jim and I haven't read the comics. So if you're a comic book fan, please keep those spoilers out, because that's not interesting. Just read a page ahead and tell everybody what the story is happening. Don't be like that. But you can send that email in to dhs@baldmove.com, and we will consider it at the end of each episode. Also, keep in mind we have forums, forums.baldmove.com, if you want to get with our fellow fans and discuss the episodes in more of a real-time cafeteria style. Before we go, there's one fun opportunity we have, since we had these screeners that we could watch in advance. We want to, if you're listening to this on the Friday that it's released, this Friday night we're going to go on twitch.tv/baldmove, and this is an Amazon Prime original, so we can do a watch party with everyone who is a Prime Video user. If you have Amazon Prime, you can go on to Twitch, and it takes about 30 seconds to link those accounts together. And then you can watch along with us. So we're going to host a watch party for these three initial episodes on Friday night. I don't know exactly when we're going to start. Check out baldmove.com for the details.
If you go to twitch.tv/baldmove, you can just sub to our channel, follow us there, and you'll get a notification when we go live.
Yeah, we'll probably start somewhere between 7 and 9 Eastern Standard Time. We'll have all this worked up, but we're recording this like a week and a half in advance. By the time you hear this, there should be more information out on our social media, at Bald Move everywhere, for that kind of stuff. But yeah, twitch.tv/baldmove, we're going to host a live watch party for the first three episodes. And it's nothing we've never been able to do before, because, you know, it's premiere. We got to see it in advance. We should be able to... It's always when we do watch things the first time through and doing a live watch, it's like hard to get much out of it, because we're trying to make jokes and keep people entertained. But it should be nice, because we've seen these multiple times. We can have some insightful things to say. We can have some funny things to say. And if you've seen it once, you kind of want to come by and see it again, or you're seeing it for the first time, check it out at twitch.tv/baldmove. And again, details will be at baldmove.com and on social media. So that's it for this week. We'll be back for, again, scene-by-scene recap-style coverage starting next week with episode 4. And we hope to see you then. And until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See you later.